Hello, everyone, and welcome to NWR's Connectivity, episode 295. I'm your host, John Reardon, and I am joined today by Neil Ronahan.
And only Neil Ronahan.
Exclusively.
That's right. We just did like two and a half hour plus podcasting episodes in the past 2 weeks. This is just going to be a two-man show, and hopefully under an hour.
Yes, I have to admit, I was kind of excited when I realized that this would not be a five-person, two-and-a-half-hour-long episode.
Had a lot of fun talking about Metroid Fusion and Metroid Dread, but now let's move on.
I'm still exhausted.
A listener mail question about Metroid. But before we get to that, I think we have some very important news that we have just researched and discovered. John and I were discussing the Nintendo Switch Online lineup that next week on Monday, October 25th, Nintendo 64 games and Sega Genesis games will be coming to Switch as part of the Nintendo Switch Online Plus expansion pack. It also includes Animal Crossing DLC coming in November, and who knows what else. Maybe it's a little overpriced. I don't know. Who cares? But the interesting part here is with N64 games, that means we can revisit some of the classics. Like one of the three RPGs on Nintendo 64, not the good one, that's Ogre Battle, but Quest 64. And I'm here to tell you, dear listener, that there's a pretty realistic chance that Quest 64 is going to wind up on Nintendo Switch Online for a few reasons. The first one is that God doesn't exist and we're all going to die.
That's the primary reason.
Or depending on your beliefs, maybe God is real and we're all going to die. I don't know.
God's real. He just hates you. He saw what you did.
But the more relevant thing is that I believe that the company that would own the rights to Quest 64, it was published by THQ in North America. It was published by Konami in Europe. However, it was published by the developer, Imagineer, in Japan. Imagineer legitimately has a working relationship with Nintendo, specifically the American and European subsidiaries, because they are the developers and publishers in Japan of Fitness Boxing 1 and 2. Fitness Boxing 2 came out last December on Switch, published by Nintendo in America and Europe. And that means that if Imagineer does own the rights to Quest 64 unquestioned, which I think is pretty reasonable considering there were reports back after, you know, in the limelight after Quest 64 came out and everybody was like, wow, an RPG on the Nintendo 64. They worked on a sequel that then got canceled. So if they were publishing their games in Japan, I would imagine that Konami and THQ probably don't. It was probably a licensing deal. It wasn't an ownership deal.
Yeah.
So that means look forward to instead of Banjo-Kazooie and Majora's Mask, the next update is going to have like Quest 64 and Aiden Chronicles.
So Quest 64, right, is even as somebody who doesn't like turn-based RPGs, it's an exceptionally bad one.
It's a bad video game. It's just a video game that I played a lot of.
Right. It's also a game that, like, I think everybody rented. Like, it is very seminal to my childhood N64 experience, despite not liking it. Much like Superman 64. But that's probably much more of a difficult licensing deal.
And just to double check, I did mention Aiden Chronicles. That game, I don't know, that probably has more of a licensing mess because that was actually published by THQ, which is a company that no longer exists. So unless THQ Nordic like got it for free in a deal for Darksiders,
listen,
I don't think Aiden Chronicles is going to come back.
If there's one thing I've learned about THQ Nordic, it's that they will publish anything they own. They just have to figure out they own it first. Like, yeah, that's the only, it's just...
Going through documents right now being like, oh.
There's two teams. There's a lawyer team and a remaster pun team, and they both make a list and they put those lists together. And when the same thing appears on both lists, they put out that remaster.
All right. So coming to Switch is Aiden Chronicles, Majelicious edition.
That's no worse than anything else
War
that they have done.
Definitive. What was it? Did Darksiders 3 have one?
No, because it hasn't been remastered.
Okay, yeah.
It's just like a port. My favorite was Remastered for Red Faction Guerrilla.
Yeah, that was bad.
Yeah, it's a bad game, but it's actually a very good remaster. And has some things in common with something we'll talk about later.
That came to Switch, right?
It did. I reviewed it.
Yeah, okay.
I don't think I gave it a good ports. Score.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good port,
but,
though.
But we do have some listener mail talking about, well, it's still Metroid. Because turns out when you do, like, I don't know, 3/4 of your runtime for a couple months about Metroid, probably more than that, actually.
It, considering all those episodes were twice the length of normal episodes. Yeah,
and then we totally talked about Metroid on episodes that weren't Game Club episodes.
Yeah, we're sorry. Yeah. Boy, I hope nobody listening to this show just, like, hates Metroid. And this has just been the worst. They're like, hey, connectivity's back. Oh,
Donald,
no.
I would like to apologize.
Donald doesn't listen. Donald, if you're listening, say something.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So Cherry Goblin wrote in, there have been recent reports of former Mercury Steam employees having their names being left out of the credits for Metroid Dread, despite seeing their own work used in the game. It turns out that the company's official policy requires developers to have stayed at the studio for 25% or more of a project's development time in order to appear in its credits. Do you think this negative press will affect Nintendo's decision to work with Mercury Steam in the future?
Do you want to answer that last question? Or
yeah, first off, thank you, Cherry Goblin, for writing.
Yes.
No, because Nintendo very likely does the exact same thing.
Yeah, this is not a and this is not to say that we agree with this practice or anything, but this is not a strange thing to do in game development at all.
It's the kind of thing where, like, good for the people from Mercury's team who got, or I guess the people who aren't at Mercury's team anymore. good for those people speaking out, because, yeah, you get hosed. And it might be a company policy. It might be a company policy that all of these people who were very likely contract employees, that they all agreed to.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make it right. That just means that, like, the recourse here is very limited, other than, yeah, I mean, I guess, like, not buying the game, not supporting Mercury's team, like that.
But this came out like 2 days after the game came out. You already bought it. It's too late.
Yeah. But I think, like, you know, hearing these people out and hoping that kind of critical mass, sharing that information with other, like, other developers, when people speak out about that, like, people should speak out about it, because that's probably the only way that change will be affected with that. I think not supporting it, like, if you're going to be like, I'm not going to buy Metroid Dread or any Nintendo game because Mercury Steam hosed their employees, that's one of those things where, like, then maybe you just don't buy video games.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Ubisoft, I think, got in trouble for doing this. Even like when you have, like, remasters, for example, I mean, I probably, you know what, honestly, THQ Nordic probably did it.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, there was one that was big in the news that we've already forgotten about, Red Dead Redemption 2 was, anyone who wasn't still at the company when the game shipped.
Yeah.
Was not in the, like, that's even worse. But,
yeah. Yeah. At least, I mean, like, the 25% thing. Like, that's I think
borderline reasonable. It feels a little, but because, like, in theory, you could have been there for a year and not quite have made the cut.
Yeah, because I think the game was in development for 4 years, which, like, kind of fun fact that, I mean, you could have guessed that, you know,
yeah,
Samus
we did
Returns
learn a thing
came out
there.
In 2017 and the game came out in 2021. Turns out, well, it was in development the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah, they moved right on. But yeah, I mean, it does kind of factor, like, the other part of this is that, like, there are instances where, like, you do have to draw a line somewhere of who to credit, because, like, not everybody working on a game is, like, a salaried member of the staff. Like, sometimes you do contract somebody for, like, a couple months to do some concept art.
Yeah.
Do you credit all of those people? Do you, and then, like, how far deep do you go, like, if you use, you know, if you buy the rights to a stock photo, so you own the rights to use it, do you still then also credit the person who got it? Do you credit the person who made all the middleware software you're using? Like, how deep do you go? You do have to have some sort of policy of setting a cutoff. Is 25% too far out? Maybe, but, like, it is reasonable to have some sort of cutoff.
Yeah, and I mean, it doesn't discount, it could be someone who was there for, you know, 10% of the development time, and it's just a real pain in the ass, and nobody liked working them, and they left on bad terms. Like, Maybe that person's not credited, but if someone's there for 24% and like it's they left the company because their mom was sick, like
or they joined like, toward the end, you know, like they may have joined in the last year and been instrumental, but it wasn't 25%.
Yeah.
So.
And I know some of the commentary out of it was that Mercury's team did allow for like you could kind of if you were only there for 20%, you could be like, hey, but like I did a lot of work and. We don't know how easy they are to work with that. I think there's, I don't want to speak 100, with 100% clarity here. I think there has been some, you know, maybe Mercury's team isn't like the greatest place to work.
There was some stuff that came out about them. They had some issues during like the Lord of the Shadow time period. Nothing really recent. But that may just be better PR people rather than nothing happening.
And we're also thinking about, I mean, maybe it's just a Metroid curse. Because Retro Studios during the development of Metroid Prime and before then, an absolute shithouse.
It really wasn't until like Echoes that like that place seems to have become a reasonably okay place to work.
And I think as of now, I mean, like it's still tough to be an American subsidiary of a Japanese company. I think there's always going to be challenges there. But I think by and large, I believe Retro Studios is a pretty okay place to work these days.
It seems like it. Yeah, at least better. There's no like porn websites being run on the company computers by the CEO or anything. So.
Spangenberg.
Oh, Spangenberg.
But yeah, I mean, like it's a practice that sucks. And I think one of the things that maybe could avoid crap like this in the future and have the right people being credited for the games no matter what, unionization. Let's do it, video game industry. Let's go.
You are kind of the odd people out in the entertainment field.
And I mean, like film had the brouhaha recently because it's like people who are like assistants and stuff, like that union trying to not be worked to the death, like they have been historically. Even theater workers, I think that's happened. Like you know, like Broadway and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Like their schedules are absolutely brutal. Like, yeah, that's the path that unionization helps for this. It helps for crediting. It's part of the reason why, but film credits are a pretty standardized process at this point, because a lot of those, I'm not going to say exactly everything. Once again, I'm not speaking with full knowledge of the film industry, but like a large portion of everything in film is union based. And, you know, maybe it's not 100% perfect, but it's better than people going uncredited and, you know, working overtime. I did get a SAG waiver one time. So I've got some experience in the biz.
But, I have an IMDb page. I'm like a professional in everything.
Did you ever work with a esteemed director, Michael Bay?
No, though I did hear him. Okay, weird tangent. I was this. That's like weirdly relevant to this. I was doing ADR for an indie film, which is in post-production when you re-record all the dialogue to get read so that you have like a clean recording of all the lines.
It's an acronym for something, isn't it?
Automated dialogue replacement. Yeah.
Okay.
And so, you essentially dub the whole movie so you just have a clean track of all the audio. We were doing this in Chicago and Michael Bay was shooting, I think it was a Transformers movie.
Wait, was it the Transformers movie that I was an extra in?
Maybe, I don't know. It was one of them. But they were shooting in Chicago.
I think that might have been 3. Because I was in 2. It would have been summer of 2008 is when I think I filmed that.
That would have been roughly, yeah. That'd be roughly right.
So maybe it was that one, but I know that.
That'd be weird if we have some weird tangential tie to the same Transformers movie.
Yeah, like my Transformers 2 extra experience was at the time I was in college, but like I live in New Jersey, and at the time my parents live relative like outside of Philadelphia, closer to Philadelphia than New York City. So a friend of mine, former Nintendo World Report staffer Josh Max told me that at the Wells Fargo Center, where like the Flyers play, like sports teams in Philly, they were having an open casting call for extras for Transformers 2. So I went there. Josh also went there. Josh also an extra in Transformers 2. Small world. But you know, went through the process there and then wound up getting cast. They shot a couple sequences in Princeton, New Jersey at Princeton University. It's the sequence, if you've ever watched that POS movie, it's near the beginning where Shia LaBeouf goes to college. The college scenes were shot. Some of them were at Princeton. I think some of them were at UPenn. I actually had another friend from high school who was an extra in the UPenn scenes. It was just a bunch of like theater dorks from you know, Central Jersey being like, let's go be in the Transformers movie. Like numerous people that I went to high school with were extras in this movie. But then, I had 2 days that I worked on it. One of them, I had a SAG waiver. So that way I got like Screen Actors Guild rates, and it like rained and stuff, and we worked longer, and I got a crap ton of money for that day. Like it was like several hundred dollars for like riding a bike down the street in Princeton on loop, and then like sitting and like playing cards, and actually humorously listening to Radio Free Nintendo episode 103.
Hey, boy, that's specific memory.
Yeah, I listened to that because like it was just like it was basically just like the what the hell is happening with this episode and trying to explain it to someone of what was happening. Like as I just had this bizarre face on because I'm like, I can't process this. But yeah, I got a couple hundred bucks. And then the second day that I was there, I did not get a SAG waiver because I think they give out waivers based on like they need to have a certain amount of union people there. And if they don't, then you get a waiver. For the second day, I got 8 hours. It was $8 an hour flat rate. I was there for 8 hours, only got 64 bucks.
Were you credited?
No, I was not.
Oh,
yeah.
You should
for my hard
stink.
Work, I was not credited.
You should
I
tell
did
Nintendo
not work 25% on the movie. Neither did Rainn Wilson, though. And he, yeah, we were in the same scene together. We were in the movie just as much.
Rainn Wilson didn't get credited?
No, he was credited in the movie.
Okay. I was very confused.
That's what you can find me in the lecture hall scene where Rainn Wilson is like an attractive professor or something. It's a weird movie. But I'm in that lecture hall pretending to fall asleep or trying to pay attention. I don't know. It's been 13 years. So anyway, what's your Michael Bay story?
So recording ADR and they were doing something a couple blocks away that involved explosions. And I don't know if you've ever recorded anything with a microphone, but it picks up the explosions really well. And so we kept having to like redo takes because there would be explosions in the background.
That's fun.
And it's a good time. I don't know if so I used to have the actual unedited audio where you could hear the explosions going off outside. It was a good time. I hate Chicago. I'm glad I haven't been to Chicago in a long time.
I mean, I don't know if you heard, but Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers owns the football team there.
I thought you were going to say he owns Chicago.
No, I mean, well,
and I was like,
too,
he should
probably.
Clean it up.
Yeah, he's got a lot of, I don't think he wants to take that on. The football stadium's trash enough.
Yeah, it's a horrible city. Sorry if you live in Chicago.
Chicago sucks. Go Blackhawks.
It does.
The Blackhawks are hilariously terrible right now. We did not do any hockey predictions. That's my bad. Xander has been on the show lately. I forgot.
Wait, is there more hockey already?
Yeah. Because now they're on a regular season. Like this is a normal season.
Oh, because of, okay. That's why it feels like it hasn't. Okay.
Yeah.
It's like, boy, they have a lot of seasons every year.
But I mean, I think Mercury's team not crediting people is sucks. It's just, unfortunately, that's
it's
what
not
the
weird.
Practice is. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Hopefully the video game, I mean, there's a lot of areas in which the video game industry could progress. And honestly, crediting people is kind of low on the, there's a lot of other things to fix.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we were talking about like, looking at this listener mail before the show that like, I think the people that worked on this game were likely paid well enough.
Yeah.
Probably a good chance that they maybe worked overtime or crunch or whatever, but they probably got good money for it. It's just they weren't credited, which, you know, at least you got like one good thing out of it, potentially.
Yeah. And, you know, once again, they probably agreed to it.
Yeah.
I don't think they were.
Yeah. Let's change the industry. Make it better. Let's do it. It's going to start now with me talking about how an old Square Enix developer made a cool video game changing the industry.
Yes, good. I was trying to figure out how to segue into that, but that works.
So I've been playing a lot of Dungeon Encounters in the past week. It's a game that came out on October 14th, was like quietly announced by Square Enix at, I think, Tokyo Game Show at like late September, like at a release date of like 3 weeks later. It's out without a lot of fanfare. I will say, full disclosure, like a day before it came out, we got contacted by PR. We're going to have an email interview with Hiroyuki Itoi from Square Enix, which I'm looking forward to getting the responses back to that. So, you know, look forward to that. It'll be somewhere on Nintendo World Report in hopefully 2 weeks. But I have been playing a ton of the game, and it's really awesome. I like sincerely and am enjoying this game a whole lot. It reminds me a lot of Etrian Odyssey, but with less of like an anime Atlas vibe and more of a tabletop gaming vibe.
I was going to say the screenshots have some almost Dungeons and Dragons vibes to them.
So it's
mixed
one of
with
things,
a crossword puzzle.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause the map, there are 100 dungeon floors that you explore. Every floor, like the backgrounds change every 10 floors, but it's a gridded map of like pathways and stuff. And you go through them as a sparsely animated character of your choosing. There's a, you know, I think there's like 8 or so that you can make a party of 4 from, and then you can find more that are trapped throughout the dungeon that you can, like, you know, unpetrify and find hidden places and stuff like that. And they range from like just like a generic sword dude to like a lion for some reason. I don't know. It's weird.
Always got to have a furry. That's important.
But as far as I can tell, like the characters are all, they're all just, you know, ciphers. They're not, there's not a lot of difference between them. You have like a couple paragraphs of like story setup, and then it's very much like Dungeons and Dragons, where it's like, I mean, it's hard to role play when you're playing a single player game, but like it is just like you have your party and you go forth into this world, you explore the dungeon. You get like rewarded with ability points for finding every square on a floor, which I don't know if it's an OCD thing or just wanting to have the nice thing of like the map telling me like, oh, you found every square, here's 3 points. But like exploring every nook and cranny of each floor has been where I've been spending a lot of my time in this video game. And the encounters, the titular dungeon encounters, they're all like, there's numbers for every encounter. They'll display in black, kind of like good events will be in white. But they all are tied to, like, you can kind of like find intel to explain, like, okay, it'll be these enemies with these weaknesses and stuff in these encounter, or this will be what will be picked in like encounter number 4. So then you'll kind of find out how to deal with that and, you know, work through it. Sometimes maybe there's four or five enemies in it. Maybe there's only 2 one time. You know, sometimes there's random boss encounters that could be a black hole that will probably lead to a total party kill, or a thief character that can steal your money until you are in debt.
Oh, I always like when video games allow me to go into debt.
Yeah, you could be at a point where you need to earn back to zero. You can't buy any items. There's like some like weirdly unfriendly parts of a game that, it is designed to be a little harsh, but like some of those things maybe a little too harsh. But the battle system itself is turn-based. It even straight up just uses active time battle from Final Fantasy games. And it is like, you know, you're tried and true, you know, select one of 2 attacks that you have equipped on your characters. It has physical defense and magic defense that, you know, different enemy attacks or your attacks on enemies will whittle down either the physical or the magic defense, and then you get to the hit points. So, you know, if you're going against an enemy that's going to be using a lot of physical attacks, maybe a boss character that does that, then maybe you tweak it so that way your armor is way more heavily favored to physical defense, or just try to keep a balanced party so that way if there's a guy that comes out and is going to hit everybody like a truck with some magic attacks, you have somebody that has very high magic defense. But it's a numbers game where you'll know, like, some weapons will be like, oh, there's a fixed amount of damage that it'll do. So you can use that to kind of calculate, like, okay, this is going to do this much damage to this character. So that'll whittle down his physical defense and I'll be able to hit his hit points for the next one. Some of them do like random amounts of damage, but usually those ones have, you know, that's greater risk, greater reward. there's even some super bizarro weapons that you can use, like a cutlery set, where depending on the enemy, you could just eat them.
Oh, okay.
There's also an urn that I found that I have like a 60% chance of just banishing a creature to a different dimension. I do have the thought in the back of my head that I'm just going to like go to a floor that it's like, hey, this is the other dimension. And then all the enemies kill me.
It's all of,
Which honestly, that would be pretty cool. But I've just been loving exploring the world. It's a lot of fun. I highly recommend it if you are of that Etrian Odyssey kind of mindset. Oh, and I didn't mention there's also riddles that you find that could be math riddles or map riddles. So map riddles will just give you like a screenshot of a floor that you do not know, and like point to a block. So you have to keep an eye out for like this assortment of blocks, and then you can find a treasure on that square. Mm-hmm. The math riddles are legitimately very harsh. The first one is like a pretty standard pattern. The next one is like prime number related. And there's another one that I think is like tied to like adding together letters of the alphabet to match up with what their number is on the alphabet. Like it's really weird and like a different type of game than what you normally play, because it's so mechanics focused. Story is an afterthought. The music is by Nobuo Uematsu, like the Final Fantasy music godfather. It kind of sucks. It's just like rock guitar riffs on classical music. Like, it's okay. But like when I found out Uematsu did it, I was like, really?
Like, everybody's got to get a paycheck occasionally.
Yeah. But it is like, I just like the combat's really fun. It is a little brutal, but like it's just like you can't blaze through it. You need to be a little more smart and thoughtful, because if a character does die, you have to leave them on that square. Okay. And then you'd have to like, you do get like, you know, the ability to revive characters and stuff. But if your whole party dies, they just remain on that square. So then you have to take one of the characters that you likely have not leveled up at all and go take them to rescue the party. You do have different items where it's like you can rearrange how the boss and the enemy encounters are at a floor, teleport around and stuff like that. I'm like 30 floors in out of the 100. It'll probably be a while before I get to the end, but I'm probably going to keep playing it. I really like this game.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like it would be a good kind of game to just have handheld for random play sessions.
Yeah, another game another Square Enix game. It was a shadow drop of the Nintendo Direct that I just haven't really talked about that much because of Metroid. And I also put it down because of Metroid. ActRaiser Renaissance is surprisingly great. I thought it looked like absolute garbage when it was shown in the Nintendo Direct. I still think the visuals have grown on me. It's still not great.
Some of the later levels look like they get a little, that first level that's like in like the forest or whatever.
Yeah.
From the gameplay I was watching just looked terrible.
Yeah. Like it, but I think here's what it does is it replicates the feeling of ActRaiser pretty well, because if you look at ActRaiser, it's an early Super Nintendo game and it does really like fun, goofy mode 7 shit. It's not exactly the prettiest looking game. And I think what Renaissance does is it just kind of captures the feeling of ActRaiser. Because ActRaiser, for as much as I adore that game, it's a really janky game. It has like, it's basically like sub-Castlevania action platforming. And then like a SimCity light that is never gets that deep. But it's still like, it's the combination of the two. It's the Yuzo Koshiro soundtrack, which you could just switch over to the original Super Nintendo soundtrack, which is great. But Yuzo Koshiro also, led the remastering of all of the music for Renaissance, and it sounds pretty good. Like, the Super Nintendo soundtrack does not need to be changed, but it's interesting seeing a guy go back to music that he wrote 30 years ago.
Yeah.
The game itself, like the action platforming side scrolling feels a little bit better. It's still a little janky, but that's kind of what I expect from ActRaiser. And like the SimCity Lite stuff actually sticks to landing. It there are more like tower defense segments. And there's this whole thing where like you have heroes in each of the areas that you're protecting that then they kind of act as like, you know, powerful characters that you can guide along in the map during these tower defense segments. But the tower defense segments really don't stick out in a negative way like they kind of did in the game I wished was a lot better, Sol Seraph, that came out on Switch a couple years ago. Like, it works. It feels like ActRaiser. Like, that's my best takeaway, is that, like, this does not replace the original entirely, but it does a really good job of feeling like it. And if you liked ActRaiser, like, check this game out. Or if you're ever curious about ActRaiser, like, it's worth checking out. There's difficulty options. Like, the tutorials are pretty solid. It's a much more, I'd say it's a much more friendly game compared to the original, especially if you're going into it, you know, in 2021 for the first time. It's really, if you wanted to know why everybody likes ActRaiser, I think this game does a pretty solid job of, like, letting people know why people dug ActRaiser.
Yeah, I was going to say, I saw that the composer had also written some new music for it, and I guess I don't know if you've messed with this, but I guess because you have the option to switch back to the SNES soundtrack, he also arranged all of his new music using SNES samples. So that when you switch back to this, when you switch back to the SNES soundtrack, all the new music is still in there, but it just sounds like the SNES soundtrack now, which is wonderful.
Yeah, like Yuzo Koshiro is maybe one of I mean, especially after Uematsu with Dungeon Encounters, you know what made Dungeon Encounters better? If it just had the soundtrack from Etrian Odyssey, which is done by Yuzo Koshiro. But like Yuzo Koshiro, like, I mean, he's the Streets of Rage games, Etrian Odyssey, probably, I mean, ActRaiser. There's a lot else that he did. But like Yuzo Koshiro freaking rules. He's also a pretty solid Twitter follow, because he also talked about when this game is released, like, kind of reflecting on memories of, because this was a Quintet game published by Enix, and Quintet is also the studio that did Soul Blazer, Illusion of Gaia, and Terra Enigma, which the fact that they're actually, like, acknowledging Quintet to some degree with ActRaiser, maybe there's hope for Soul Blazer, Illusion of Gaia, and Terra Enigma to, like, come out on modern platforms, because that trilogy is extremely overlooked and underrated. Maybe not underrated, because people who have played Terra Enigma are like, this is the greatest Super Nintendo game of all time, and it's a very good video game. But, like, they haven't been accessible for very... Terra Enigma never came out in America. Like...
Yeah. Did it come out in Europe?
Yeah.
Okay, so it has an English localization.
Yeah.
Put it on... I wonder what the, like, payout breakdown for Nintendo Switch Online is.
I would imagine that part of the reason why it's a lot more money for the expansion pack is because, like...
Oh, the licensing. Yeah.
Yeah, if you think about, like, they have a bunch of Konami and Capcom games.
That are Konami and Capcom games for a system they do not own.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Double and licensing. C4,
like, guess what? Banjo-Kazooie ain't cheap, kids. Like,
yeah. Yeah, they have to license their stuff from Microsoft, which is bizarre. And yeah, no, there is, I'm sure, a lot more cost associated with these two platforms than there were with the last one. And I know I've heard from a couple people that, like, we don't know what they pay for these games, but it sounds like they pay well. So
yeah,
but that does make, like, if I owned a bunch of classic SNES games that had never been re-released, I guess, unless I wanted to hold out so that I could release my own, you know,
just
release
it,
of them,
just
but
do
then
it.
Do it.
Yeah, please.
Like,
it's
yeah,
like, people like those video games.
Yeah.
You like, guess what? Collection of Mana. Trials of Mana on Super Nintendo isn't that good.
Yeah.
And that wasn't even, you had to find that localization from Nintendo.
Yeah.
These games actually came out.
Maybe they'll do the Trials of Mana thing and they'll remaster them as 3D games with horrible voice acting.
But yeah, I mean, I think this ActRaiser game got a little maligned because it definitely does not give a great first impression by its visuals. Also, a bunch of stuff came out where people were like, Platinum Games wanted to do a remake of ActRaiser, and Square Enix said no, but they greenlit this bullshit. And it's like, guess what? Like, what was the last good Platinum Games game? Bayonetta 2.
Astral Chain, thank you.
Oh, yeah. But
fucking,
like,
Star Fox, god damn it.
I mean, Nintendo did more work on that. Than
All right. I guess they did they published Astral Chain too, if you want to get out of that one.
Yeah, yeah. So everything that they did with Nintendo is good. But like, have you seen Babylon's Fall?
Yeah, I get that. And what's the Final Fantasy game that looks terrible?
Oh, yeah. Stranger in Paradise.
Yeah, the one about killing chaos.
Yeah.
Which I've heard is fine.
Yeah.
But like, goddamn, it's ugly as sin. Yeah.
But yeah, please, Square, remember that you own Enix. Like, or yes. You are a part of you. The Enix is a part of you.
We need, what we need is for THQ Nordic to approach Square Enix about licensing some of their old stuff.
Yes.
Because THQ Nordic has the courage to release trash no matter what.
Yep.
And like, Square Enix is terrified of ever touching their old catalog unless it's Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah. Yeah. They'll do that over and over again. Still waiting for the Pixel remasters on Switch. So maybe I should wait for those and then start begging for other Super Nintendo games.
Did they ever fix the font?
I don't think so.
Oh, good.
But I mean, like, so far they've only, I don't think 5 has come out yet. I know they've had 1, 2, 3, and 4 have all come out, but I think 5 is probably coming out soon, because I think they had the first 3 in July, and then I think they were doing like every other month. So I think 4 came out in September. So that means 5 will probably be out in November sometimes.
Yeah,
but that's all I got. I'm playing basically that. No, this is all I'm playing. Other than like toddler experiences playing. So
this
Mario.
Is all you're allowed to talk about.
Yes.
Secretly, you're playing Breath of the Wild too, but like, ooh, that's under embargo still. So we're not allowed to talk about that.
Then I might, maybe I'll replay Metroid and then we can have another episode about it.
That's fine. I did 100% it.
Yeah, yeah, I think, I did that before recording last week, but...
Yeah, yeah, I'm definitely not game. First to 100. It's the first Metroid game besides Other M, so it's the first real Metroid game that I've ever actually 100%ed, so that's how I know that it's the best one, because I wanted to keep playing it.
That's what, I think I, like, broke Justin Berube's mind when I told him that Metroid Other M was the first Metroid game I ever 100%ed.
It's very easy. You can kind of do it accidentally.
One, it's not hard. Two, the payoff for getting 100% is actually great.
Yeah.
Because you get the Fantoon boss fight. Like, it's totally worth 100%ing that. Whereas, like, all the other games, it's just kind of like, well, that's done. Like, I got a different... I guess in Samus Returns, you get, like, the tease for Dread.
Yeah, it's usually... it's. I mean, I've seen the 100% ending for every Metroid, but it's usually the type of thing, which ironically, I don't know if this counts as spoilers for Dread, but it does not have an interesting 100% ending.
No,
it really isn't much there, but like, there's some neat art. And I mean, I did it because it was fun, not because I wanted a cool ending, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, but if I replay Metroid Dread, it's not going to be to like unlock different art. I can just look at that online.
Yeah. You know what's not as good as Metroid Dread?
Every video game?
Yes, but in particular, Crisis.
You know what's not as good as Metroid Prime? Crisis.
Yeah. You know what's not as good as like as most games that have the legacy that it has? Crisis.
That's disappointing to hear. I've never really played Crisis before, but I heard the Switch ports were technically impressive.
I guess so. So it's weird. So, okay. So
you're going to go counter to, right. I think Digital Foundry had a very positive Crisis.
I agree with everything they said, and I get where their mindset was. But Crisis, for anyone who hasn't been aware of it. It was a game that originally released for PC, that was like super technically demanding. Like, we have the phrase about Doom where we say, like, everything can run Doom because it's just, like, it just runs on everything. Even at the time, it ran on everything, except maybe the Super Nintendo.
They tried.
They did their best. Crisis is the opposite of that, where it was, even at the time, very difficult to run well. It was just an extremely technically demanding game that made tons of advancements for, like, physics and things like that. So it's an important game. And was a big like PC Master Race thing. It got ported to 360 and PS3, where it ran like absolute trash. But this was the 360 and PS3 era where we just released stuff. Like, it didn't matter if it ran or not. We just kind of put it. That's the thing I forget about that era. Because even like Far Cry 3, which everybody loved, ran at like 15 frames per second. Like, yeah. That game is, it runs terribly, but that was just where we were at the time. So Crysis Remastered came out on everything, including Switch, and it still runs terribly. But it does run better than it did on PS3. So, and for context, that's like, it runs higher than 12 frames per second. So yeah, there's been like Digital Foundry did a video talking about it, very impressive. And it does some more cool technical stuff that's very impressive. But there were times where I had to put it down because, like, one of the things this game does is, you know, like, every building and tree is fully destructible. But when that happens, the game not just like slows down, but it'll just stop to think for a while. So like, you'll throw a grenade into a building and the game will just pause while it goes, all right, I have to figure out how to blow this building up. And then it'll unpause to like blow everything up. And so when you're in a big firefight, that's just constantly happening. And it, like, the physics will occasionally freak out and like characters will kind of glitch around as the game tries to do all the math for where everyone should be. And it's just a mess. But yes, it's better than it used to be. On top of all of that, it's kind of a bad game. Like, it's definitely one of those games where it was more focused on what it wanted to do on a technical level than be a game. It's a tech demo. And so it just, like, the story of it feels like they were making it up as they went along. The level design is borderline non-existent. Like, it got a lot of praise for having these really big maps where you could kind of do levels however you wanted, but it kind of more just feels like they didn't design levels. Like, they just put you at one half of the map and said, your goal's over there.
I don't know, you do it.
Yeah. And like, when it works, like when everything kind of aligns and you get like the physics happening and all that, you do get a little of that, you know, the same kind of magic you get out of Breath of the Wild, where, you know, where in Breath of the Wild, you might be in the middle of a fight and you throw a bomb and it not only takes out some enemies, but like, it knocks down a tree and then that tree hits an enemy and you're like, oh, that was cool. Like, Crysis has a little bit of that, where you'll be fighting in like a forest or something and a stray bullet will hit a tree and the tree will go down and it looks cool and it's neat. But that's about the extent of it. But the whole experience, because I finished it last night, because I got the remastered trilogy, because, I mean, why would you only want to play one Crysis game that you don't like when you could play three? But it got me thinking last night I was playing it, because I was like, this reminds me a lot of The Conduit on Wii, which is another game that is on a technical level insane, but isn't so insane as far as being a good game goes. That just, it reminded me of this, that this used to be a thing in video games, especially console games, I feel, where like every platform had some first person shooter that was just like the way the system showed off what it could do. So like Crysis, while it was on other systems, was very much like the PC version of that. Conduit was that for Wii. Halo was that for Xbox, and probably Killzone was that for PlayStation. And only Halo of all of those is a remotely good game.
And I don't even think like Halo's story is just a bunch of corridors.
The first one had a bunch of open areas. Well, like, I when mean, you first like, land on the
connected
ring.
Connected by corridors.
Well, yeah, that's the limitation. Same. There's a lot of S turns.
Yeah.
But that's first person shooters of that. That time.
Especially that era. Like, I was surprised at, when I got my Series X, I downloaded Master Chief Collection and played the first couple levels of Halo 1. And I will say, like, still very rough, way more fun than I expected it to be. Like, there's just something about the way that Bungie captured, like, just like shooting with the different weaponry that you have in those games. It's, there's a reason why that multiplayer was so kinetic and fun in the early days.
Yeah, and it's they got the gameplay loop down really well, which a lot of these other technically impressive shooters leaned way more into the being technically impressive, except the first Killzone. That, I don't know if you've ever played Killzone on PS2.
I have
that
not.
Game sucks, and it doesn't look good, but it was all PlayStation had, I guess.
What was that GameCube? Like Geist?
Geist, yeah.
No, I mean, I guess GameCubes would be, would it be Prime?
You know, that would be fair. Yeah.
But also Prime 2 did have multiplayer, famously.
And I don't think this whole mentality really hit until like the PS3, 360, Wii, the seventh generation.
Yeah.
Because we must number them. Because that's when you started to see, like, you know, that was when HD hit. And it felt like the console wars were very much ignited anew. And first person shooters were in their golden age, or their heyday at least. And
yeah.
So everybody needed an exclusive one.
Yeah, just crack open your Book of Ayn Rand, come up with BioShock.
Yeah. Hey, BioShock is at least a good game.
It was on deep discount, but I forgot to get. I was thinking,
have you not played
Switch.
BioShock? Do you want to do a BioShock game BioShock. Club?
No. I mean, I've never played two.
That's fine.
I played one. I liked one back in the day. I think that game does a good job of like almost Metroid Dread comparison. The illusion of thinking that you have more options than you actually do.
Sure.
I mean, I feel like there's also thematic with BioShock 1.
Right, that was the point, getting into spoilers.
I had a ton of fun with that video game. Never played 2. I think BioShock Infinite is top 5 most disappointing video game experiences.
Oh, really? I loved BioShock Infinite.
I was looking forward to it. It was Xenoblade 2-esque is how I went excited for the game, like had it pre-ordered or whatever. I didn't buy the digital, like all DLC included edition like I did with Xenoblade 2, which was
that was a choice mistake. You made.
Yeah. I was just like, well, yeah, I'm totally gonna enjoy this video game.
I have no evidence to support this, but
didn't like anything in BioShock Infinite except for that there's always a lighthouse, there's always a girl or whatever. Like that, I like that bit. I like the video game story of it all, even if the path it took to get there was kind of stupid.
I liked it. We should do a BioShock game club.
Sure, we can do that with the Darksiders one. Yeah,
yeah.
I do recommend. I think you read it. The new Jason Schreier book, Press Reset, is basically just the BioShock development history. Like that's like two-thirds of the book is people from BioShock being overworked and then making their own studios and having their own problems.
Yeah, it's so... Yeah, the way it all, like, a lot of the stories kind of tie together. I've never read such a bummer of a book that
about
I was so
I
happy
liked.
To be reading. Yeah, yeah. I wasn't sad. He does a really good job of balancing, like, he's going to tell you a bunch of bummer stories, but, like, in a not intentionally distressing way.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, I came away from it having even more respect and admiration for Warren Spector.
Oh, yeah.
Warren Spector rules.
Well, it briefly mentioned Wing Commander, so it,
yeah,
it met makes with you my happy. Qualifications. Yep. So
talked about Flame of the Flood. Flame of the Flood, fantastic video game on Switch.
Yeah, I kept the entire time I was going through it, like I would forget how recent of a book it was.
Yeah.
And then it would mention something from like yesterday.
Like Dreads Hollow came out
last
week.
And I was like, Jesus,
week.
All right. this just happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, great book. Really liked it. I should probably read it. I haven't done Blood, Sweat, and Pixels.
That's, I think Press Reset's a great change. Blood, Sweat, and Pixels is a good read. But Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, it wasn't until after I finished it that I was talking to someone where they pointed out that like, pretty much every story in Blood, Sweat, and Pixels is like a white dude.
Oh, sure.
And that's like it was I actually saw a comment from Jason Schreier who was just like, nah, I got it, like go fix it in the second one, like was not on purpose.
Yeah. Well, Blood, Sweat, and Pixels is a more positive book, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's not as quite like Press Reset is pretty.
Yeah. And even in like his intro to Press Reset, he even talks about how like the first one, like he tried to be more journalistic and not make a decision on it. And here he was like, no, like the video game industry is fucked. We need to change it.
Yeah, he clearly has something to say going into it. Definitely. My favorite part of that whole book is the entire Kingdoms of Amalur and all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Segment. That's.
Yeah. I mean, one, fuck Kurt Schilling. Just eternally.
But maybe not. Yeah.
No,
I think they got Kurt paid Schilling. Recently.
Oh yeah,
all those employees I think finally got their I don't think it was all the money they were supposed to get, but they did get a paycheck.
I still presumably will just say fuck her chilling. But at the same time, I think that book does a good job of being like, he just wanted this to happen. And he did a lot of dumb things along the way, but it came from a place of he wanted to make the coolest video game possible. It's just that he didn't really know what he was doing.
Yeah, it definitely feels like it comes more from a place of ignorance than like evil or anything like that.
Yeah, not I mean, like very Lionel Hutsy, but not that vindictive, maybe.
Yeah, like an incredible level of ignorance.
But also like, fuck her chilling.
Sure.
Listen, I don't care that much about baseball, especially as much as I used to, but like I did grow up and I'm technically still am a New York Yankees fan. So like by law, much like any Chicago listener, when I made a comment about Aaron Rodgers, you could go tell me to F off. Like that's fair. Just like I'm a Yankees fan, ergo, if you're like, hey, Curt Schilling is doing something in Boston, I can be like, well, I hope he chokes on something. Like, that's just the way it is.
I did have a moment playing Kingdoms of Amalur where I think I mentioned to my wife that I think her parents, at least at one point, owned part of this game.
Yeah.
Because I believe it went to the taxpayers of Rhode Island, so.
Yeah, because they were in Massachusetts. They were, because he's, you know, he made his bones being a Boston Red Sox pitcher. He was very good on the Phillies, too. That was before I hated him. But yeah, then he moved from Massachusetts to Rhode Island and then got the state of Rhode Island on the hook for a lot of money.
Which also, like, I mean, you can also put some of that blame on the state of Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Like, there were several bad decisions along the way by several people.
It's a very much recommend that book.
Mm-hmm.
So now the conduit. Are we going to try to hope that High Voltage Software comes? Are they even still around?
I think so. Let's look it up. What I was going to say, so what bothered me after finishing the first Crisis was that despite being, I think, a worse game overall than the first Conduit, there are three Crisis games, and I only got two Conduit games.
Yeah, we need Conduit.
And I haven't got to the end of I haven't got to the end of Crisis 2 yet, but I really doubt it will possibly compare with the ending of Conduit 2. So yeah. I really, if I could trade them
Conduit
all,
Conduit 2 is incredible.
I got to look up High Voltage Software.
They're working on a bunch of VR titles.
Oh, cool.
I think they're still around. The last update seems to have been from 2015, which is a little concerning. They might have gotten bought out by another company.
Probably THQ Nordic.
They have like under their logo, it says a keyword studio.
I have Wikipedia has them up to 2019.
Okay, cool.
They apparently did Zombieland Road Trip. Oh, with Game Mill. They can make garbage Nickelodeon games.
They're working on Fortnite.
Are they?
Yeah, apparently. That's on their website. It says that they helped out with Fortnite Chapter 2 Season 3.
No.
And The Walking Dead. Oh, yeah, that Walking Dead game that came out on VR. That came out in 2020.
Well, good for them.
They should talk to Sega.
They briefly had an Android port of the first Conduit, but I believe
I don't know if they own the rights or not.
That's a good question. Sega should license that to somebody who... You know what? Conduit 2 was an okay game. Conduit 1 is kind of bad, but like Conduit 2 is they listened to the critiques of the first one and they made changes.
That is true.
Conduit 2 is a significantly better game. It was like just, I mean, especially the first one was just a tech demo for their engine, which I believe only they ever used. I don't think they ever successfully licensed it.
And then they had all those
anybody.
Other games. We have some of the only footage from like E3 2010 of
the Grinder. Oh God.
Yeah, the Grinder. Yeah.
I was hyped for that game when it got announced.
It looked pretty, like the concept of it was really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Saw it at E3. I think we were there after the show floor closed. They had like the second floor of a booth or something. But it was a neat game that then got turned into a top down shooter and may or may not have ever come out.
I don't think it did, right?
It might
Unless it came out under a different name.
It might have been a different name. I don't know.
Okay, well,
that might be an episode.
I think that's the end of the episode.
We reached the conduit tipping point.
That's how you know you're at the end is when you hit. I will say I had a waking dream where I was playing the conduit in 4K. The conduit 2 in 4K, and like looks pretty good. it's impressive. You get that game off the Wii, and like, I think it's, they should at least port the first two to Switch.
Yeah, kick the can, see if there's interest. There probably won't be, but let's see.
Yeah,
next time we bring up The Conduit, I'll share my New York Comic Con stories about that game.
Okay.
Because that was one of my first press events that I ever went to, was loitering at the Sega booth, playing the demo for House of the Dead Overkill and The Conduit.
So everybody make sure to vote for The Conduit as our next game club.
Yeah, we don't know what our next game club is. We're just going to keep on adding things to the list and hope it shakes out. We just need a break. Where this episode's going to be like an hour long. I'm so excited.
Yeah. If we haven't done another game club by the time Metroid Prime 4 gets a legit trailer, the next one will be the Metroid Prime trilogy.
Yeah. I still want to do something on Kirby, but like, I don't know.
That's true. We do have a new... You got to give me a subset of Kirby, though, because I'd have to buy all of those.
I think it's the kind of thing with a Kirby game club, need to like come up with some kind of plan.
Yeah.
Of like, what games are we playing? It might be like, I don't know, maybe there's something about like looking in to see what it's called, Forgotten Land. Is that the new one? Look to see like what games would be representative of what they're doing. So like Kirby 64, I think, would definitely be a part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, then it might just get to the point where it's just like me like picking out Kirby games that I want to replay. So like
Air Ride's the only actually 3D one. So that's obviously what this is a sequel
that
to.
3D Blowout Blast or whatever that came out on 3DS, the download game.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The like Smash Bros type.
No, there's one that's like a grid based. I never played it. There was like a sub mode in Robobo, I think.
Oh, okay. Oh, it almost looks 3D Land esque.
Yeah.
Huh.
But whatever we do, I think I might make the party play Star Allies legitimately, because I still will die on the hill that while I do think Planet Robobo is the best of the most recent trilogy of Kirby games, people dunk way too hard on Star Allies. It's like, it's a totally fine game.
How I know I'm completely outside of any Kirby discourse is I have no idea what people consider the best of the modern Kirby games.
Star Allies is pretty good.
I understand. I mean, Planet Robobo is more fun to say.
Yeah. It also has all the mech stuff. The mech stuff is really cool.
Yeah. Hopefully there are mechs in Forgotten whatever.
Man. There's like a potential for that game that makes me very excited. And then there's also the reality of that game where it's like, it's probably going to be very simple.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you want it to be the Mario 64 of Kirby.
Yeah.
But
like, I want it to just be Mario Odyssey Kirby. Like, that's, make it that video game. I don't know. They've never done a game on that scale before.
Yeah.
But I'd be curious to check it out, because I think it's the same team at HAL that worked on Triple Deluxe, Robobo, and Star Allies. And yeah, like,
Is Sakurai remotely involved in Kirby at this point?
Okay. I think he still voices DDD.
Well, that's good.
I think that's it.
Because that's honestly, that's what Kirby needs, is a Sakurai reboot.
That, I mean, yeah, let's see what goes on with Forgotten Land. And if it sucks, then I will be pro Sakurai come home to your boy.
Yeah.
The last Kirby game that he worked on was Subspace Emissary. was Air Ride. Air Ride was the last Kirby game that he worked on.
Yeah.
Although I think technically he worked on Nightmare in Dreamland, which I think might have been either the same year or right after Air Ride. But Air Ride's awesome.
If he reboots it, he'll make it incredible, and then there will never be another sequel to it.
Well,
Kid Icarus Uprising.
Yeah, because then he'll have to make another Smash Brothers. It's how the world works.
I'm really hoping that Bandai Namco coming more and more into Smash Bros. Means that like maybe they can just take it over. And he can just work in like some sort of advisory role. He could be like a producer on it, but
I'll be real. I think the only way that Sakurai lets Smash Brothers go is when he dies.
I can't get a read for how much he likes doing it versus like how much he just feels like he should, or like the money's too good.
Yeah, it could be guilt from Iwata. Like maybe Iwata was just a like lifetime contract of millions of dollars. Whenever we want to do a Smash Brothers, you get first right of refusal. It was like Iwata like made sure this contract was done in his last year of life. Like,
yeah,
because I mean that's a big part of the reason why like Ultimate happens. Like that's why we are somewhat uncharted territory for the future of the series, because a lot of why Sakurai kept on coming back was because of Iwata. And yeah. Iwata got him to make Ultimate, and I think Sakurai, I haven't kept up with all of like the articles and that his first column and stuff, everything he's ever said and everything that's been misattributed to him over the years. I believe he made some comment along the lines of like Ultimate, you know, he's working on Ultimate and making as good as he can in memory of his friend.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's something that was said at some point. And
that,
you know,
sounds familiar. Yeah.
Still haven't played Sora. Still haven't played Kazuya. Still haven't played Mithra and Pyra. Myra and Pythra.
good old Pyra.
But I do think, I think I'm going to do another, World of Light playthrough, just because I feel like that's a good way. I don't like playing online as much. And I don't play video games with friends locally these days. Yeah. Something about children, something about COVID. It'd be cool if I did. Like, let's go to PAX and play some Smash, y'all.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe East. Let's see what the world's at.
I'm feeling optimistic.
Yeah.
I'll get a booster before we go and we'll be all set.
Yeah.
Top it off.
Hell yeah.
All right. Thank you very much for listening. If you have listener mail about the video game industry behind the scenes or anything else you want to talk about, maybe it's
Metroid movies,
maybe it's Skyward Sword, maybe you still have some lingering thoughts about Skyward Sword,
any game club recommendations,
that's a good idea, actually.
Sure. Or like what we should do. Berg is still going to do this weekly, but like I don't know, after Metroid I'm so tired.
Yeah. Send those to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. follow us on Twitter at ConnectivityNWR. If you're listening to this on a platform where you can rate and review it, you could do that. You could share it with a friend. You could do some marketing for us, because we sure as hell ain't gonna. And we'll see you next time. Thanks as always, Neil. And goodbye. This was made possible by our generous supporters on Patreon. Check out patreon.com/NWR for all the details.